Hello, everyone. Let me get the dates here. What are we? The 18th, November 18th. Well, I didn't last class. I wanted to begin get right in there with the new material, and we'll get to that as well. But I do want to respond to a few comments already dealing with the previous class. Okay, so someone didn't understand the Chazon Ish's position, the criticism, I should say, of the Musar school, what the Musar school was saying about biblical stories. Again, I'll just give you one example. This is from Gnazim B'Shevas Tshuvas Chazon Ish, Volume 5, page 148. This is what Rav Yitzhak Scher was saying, that he asks, what's the sin? If you just read the Nach, you read Shoftim, Shmuel, etc., you'll conclude that they worshipped idols, the people. And that was a big problem. I think we can say that they were monolatrists. That is, they believed in God, but they also believed in the existence of other gods. And the problem was to keep them from falling into the Eitz HaRa to worship the other gods. So what does Rabbi Scher say? He says that, you know what their great sin was? Because they were so close to God, they forgot what they promised Yahushua, and they didn't destroy all the idolatry that was in the land. Why didn't they destroy all the idolatry? Because they were so connected to God. That's why they didn't destroy it. And that was such a sin, he says, that the Nach speaks of them in the signon, the form, she'ilu heim atzmam avdu as ha'balim v'asheros. So when Nach refers to them as worshiping the Baal and the Asherahs, it's not that they really did it. It's not even that they didn't uproot all these idols. It was the fact that they were so connected to God that they were just focused on their own worship of God that they never they forgot about what they had to do, getting rid of the idols. The Chazon Ish sees that as a complete distortion, ruining the Nach, what it's trying to tell us. It's Megala Panim Shol Kalacha. He sees it as, I mean, his language is so, he says, we can't even talk to each other if you can't even accept what Nach says, something which he also says all the Rishonim agree, that this was real idolatry. And you can't, in the 20th century, just make up this thing that even though it says they worshiped idols, they didn't really worship idols. Now, granted, we have examples where the Gemara says things like that, but that's the Gemara. But a 20th century figure can't invent this sort of thing. It reminds me of Rav Aaron Cutler's critique of people who he doesn't mention individuals by name, but you could say put Rav Shamsham Raphael Hirsch in there, who criticized the Avos, say that the Nach is telling, Shar is telling us here that, let's say, Avraham made a mistake in this or Yitzhak in that. He sees this as completely out of line. So you can say to Rav Aaron Cutler, well, didn't the Ramban say that? By the way, it's not just the Ramban. The Zohar also mentions as well. But Rav Aaron would say the Ramban could say it. We can't say it, and that's what the Chazon Ish is saying. He sees it. I mean, his language is so sharp. So that's what the Chazon Ish says. Now, the other matter of the Chazon Ish that people were, at least three of you, emailed me, citing. Well, what about Shlomo? Shlomo cites. He says, what's the Chazon Ish talking about? Hold on a second here. I got to, we're going to get to this in a second. My problem is I can't, I got to get rid of this thing on my screen here. Going to show you this in a second. You'll see why, but I got to move this. I got a thing on the top of my screen. Okay, I got rid of it. Okay, so what does it say in Pasuk, this is a Shmos 23, Pasuk 8. It says, don't take a gift, a bribe, for a gift blindeth them that have sight, perverted the words of the righteous. Okay, so it's explicit Pasuk here that bribe, that taking a bribe perverts your judgment. So what was the Chazon Ish talking about then? Well, the Chazon Ish was not talking about the masses. Obviously, for the regular person, You take money, you're not going to see things clearly. But he's saying that that's not an issue for tzaddikim. And it's a gzeiras hakasuv for them. Don't think that the tzaddikim were concerned about that. And he brought a good proof that we know that if I'm a great tzaddik, let's say, and I have a halachic decision which could cost me millions of dollars, I don't have to recuse myself and ask someone else to paskin it. I can paskin it myself for me, for my children, for my wife. And he says that shows you we're not concerned about tzaddikim, Gedolei Yisrael, being led astray by monetary matters. So that also answers the question that Zvi, you dealt with. You showed me then Bechoros. I know this Gemara because I cited in Changing the Immutable, where it has a story there where it says that when you deal with a Torah scholar who's issuing a ruling in halacha relevant to him, if he stated the ruling before the incident, that is, before is relevant, you listen to him. Afterwards, you don't listen to him because he might have had negios. The Chazon Ish says that all these stories in the Gemara are either rabbinic things that were added on to be extra kalfro or they're divrei chasidus. But he says that the Torah is not concerned with this at all. Having said that, I want to thank Tzvi as well for sending me something from the Satmar Rebbe in last week's Parsha, who disagrees with the Chazon Ish. The Satmar Rebbe has a good, excellent question, actually. Let me show you the question. He cites on Rashi. Rashi says in Perachav Beis, in this Pasuk, when the angel says, don't put your hand to the nar, because now I know you're a God-fearer. So what does Rashi say? Rav Abba says, Avram says, I'm going to explain my complaint to you. Yesterday you said, in Isaac your seed will be called. Then you retracted and said, now take your son. And now you're saying to me, don't stretch forth your hand. So the Satmar Rebbe says, wait a second, why does Avraham wait till the third thing? He says, in Isaac your seed is going to be called, then go take your son to sacrifice him. And the third thing is, he says, don't sacrifice him. Why does Avraham need to wait to the third thing to understand what's going on here? Couldn't he have said it earlier? Right after God says, go sacrifice him, he should have said, well, wait a second. Didn't you tell me my descendants are going to come out of Yitzchak? There's a stira right there. So the Satmar Rebbe says, when you have a negiah, you can't, this is in his Kedushas Yo, when you have a negiah, you can't understand the other side, even if someone explains it to you, because the negios affect you. And therefore, when God says to Avraham to sacrifice his son, Avraham had a negiah. He loved his son. So he couldn't ask Hashem then to explain it because he wouldn't understand it. He had a negiah. It's only later, after the fact, when it is sacrifice, and then you can want to know what's going on here. So here we have the Satmar Rebbe explaining that even Avraham had a negiah, and he recognized that he had a negiah. I don't know what the Chazon Ish would reply to that. But again, like I said, it's not just this. That's the Rishonim are full of explanations that assume that there's a negios. So it's an unusual position of the Chazon Ish. I'm not sure how to answer it. And finally, Ruvain asks, and this stuff about the pool, the Ponevezh pool. Here, by the way, is another picture of it where it says, The pool, which is in the Tchum of Yeshivas Ponevezh in the heart of Bnei Brak, me'achar v'lo hayu bonos, the yeshiva panimia. Since there were no girls in the yeshiva and the dormitory, that the swimming, haisa al taras hagvarim. It was only men. All I know about this, and how I found out about this, is because there's in the biography of Rav Shar Yosef Cohen, called Ha'ish HaLeida, it mentions that Rav Kahaneman explained to him that he wants to establish a swimming pool in the yeshiva for the Bachrim. So when I saw that, I Googled it, you know, because I never heard of that. And lo and behold, these pictures come up from the 40s where you do have a swimming pool in the yeshiva. So I know nothing more about it. And who gave the money? Was it the city that paid for it? For all I know, the city was intent on setting up a swimming pool. And Rav Kahneman said, well, set it up here. I didn't have to raise the money. I know nothing about it other than the picture I just showed you, which is not the same one I showed you before, because the one I just showed you now actually has a description. And what I see in the book, Ha'ish HaLeida, page 48. Let us now pick up where we were. I want to show you. I mentioned last class. Let's see. This individual. This is the one I was referring to. I couldn't remember what his title was. He passed away in 98. He was Mankal, I guess, the director of the Misrad Hadatot, Shmuel Zalman Kahana. That's the son of the great Rav Shlomo David Kahana. And he was the one who told me, and he would have been in a position to know, obviously. He was 20 years, it says, that head of the Misrad Hadatot, and he told me that Rav Huttner very much wanted to be chief rabbi of the state of Israel. And thank you, Ian, for sending me. If anyone's interested, I discussed briefly last class this notion, which that non-Jews are not obligated in the Shem Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. The strange idea. I believe I was the first one, till now maybe the only one, to write about this in English in my review of Jonathan Sachs's book, Dignity of Difference. And I remember as I'm investigating this, it's blowing me away because I never heard this. And it's so strange because then what does that mean? That is, if non-Jewish societies can set up any system they want, murder can be okay. So like I said, I think you have to assume that certain natural laws still apply, but it's very strange. So, Ian, I thank you for sending me an article from an unpublished responsum from by Yisachar Katz from a couple of years ago. I could send it to everyone. I haven't checked all of his sources, but I did check some of his sources, and it is much fuller and more complete than what I wrote about. And again, it blows me away. Loads and loads of Rishonim and Achronim who either state explicitly or seem to imply, despite the Gemara, but they have a way of reading the Gemara that I spoke about, that non-Jews are not obligated to Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. And therefore, we don't need to encourage them to do it. God doesn't punish them for this, in complete opposition to the Rambam. And Rabbi Katz's point was about should we be involved in trying to influence the non-Jews on abortion? Because it's the seventh Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, and according to the Rambam, they're obligated not to do abortions. So that's why he gets into that whole discussion. So thank you very much, Ian. Let us begin. Here, incidentally, I didn't show you. Here's a picture of Rav Oliver. That's the famous picture. Let me stop sharing this, and let's pick up right where we were. You recall we spoke about how Rav Moliver said it's vital that that young people being educated learn to speak the language of the land, Russian, in his case. Well, it's not only Rav Moliver, and it's not only Russian. I'm going to show you something here. This is published in 2024, Mille de'Igros. I told you how I got all of the letters, collect the letters of Rav Gifter, and I happen to love these letters. It's great for the history of Orthodoxy in America. So in volume, what is this? Volume 8, pages 598 on, he has a letter here. It's titled, it's from 1984, Chovas ben Torah Hashlim Atzmo B'Ktiva V'Lashon, B'Ktiva V'Lashon, V'Gam B'Sfas HaMedina. The obligation for yeshiva students to speak English properly. And he writes, he says, part of it's in English. He says, you have to perfect yourself in the English language, in speaking and writing. And then he says, in Hebrew, he says, don't be like most yeshiva students who thinks that what I'm saying are Devarim B'Teilim. He says, Bizmanenu, today, Efshar Lekadesh Shem Shemayim Rabbi Ladas Anglit. I should read it as Sephardic. You can't be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim without knowing Anglit. And listen to this. V'Anglit Shemedabrim B'Yeshivot, the English they speak in yeshivas, Eina Lo Lashon V'Lo Safa. That is Yinglish, yeshivish. That they speak in yeshivas is not English, it's not Safa, not Lashon. Sometimes you hear these rabbis like on tapes or on podcasts, And they speak perfect English. Other times you hear them, and every other word is a Gemara expression or Hebrew or Yiddish. And I think sometimes that if people I work with, non-Jews, were to listen to us, they wouldn't understand it. Literally, they couldn't understand it because almost every sentence has an expression. I don't mean non-Jews, people with not a good yeshiva background wouldn't understand it. I don't even know if people, I don't even know if women, even with all the years of Jewish education and even having gone to seminaries, would understand it, because a lot of the lingo is like the Yiddish type of yeshivish lingo that you don't learn. I don't know if Israelis, Talmid Chachamim, could understand a lot of it. If you haven't been like Ashkenazic Haredi type yeshivas, you wouldn't understand this. Here, Rav Gifter saying, don't speak like that. He says you can learn a good English well by reading the books of Art Scroll. He says read the Hakdamos of their Chumash and Tanakh of Rav Nosson Sherman. Rav Nosson Sherman, he speaks a good English, he says. Umizet titragel basafa. And so here's Rav Gifter stating that the importance of speaking proper English. You know, he's American born. So it was a little, and he didn't grow up yeshivish. I mean, he went to yeshiva, but at first he grew up just in a regular household. That's important. Okay, let's continue. I started talking about this piece in Halavana, and I just want to read you a few more things that appear there. Ramolover says, this is from December 11th, 1872. It's not reprinted in the writings that this volume I showed you last class of that Magid reprinted, the collected writings of his work. He raises a very interesting question, Ramolover. There seems to be a stira in the Gemara. On the one hand, the Gemara says here in Menachos, 99b, it says that Ben Dama, the son of Rabbi Shmuel's sister, asked Rabbi Shmuel. He says, I've learned the entire Torah. So what about learning Greek wisdom? And Rabbi Shmuel said to him, you know, the Torah should not depart from your mouth, contemplate it day and night. He says, find me an hour, go and search for an hour that's neither day nor night and learn Greek wisdom. So this is a famous passage in the Gemara that, yes, you want to learn secular studies, because it says that you have to study Torah, Yom Ha'Vilayla. So find me something that's not Yom Ha'Vilayla, and then you can learn it. And that's always cited. However, Rav Molover points out there's a stira, because there's another Gemara which says in, this is Brachos 35b, here. So what does Rabbi Shmuel say? It says you shall gather your grain. And then, what about the Torah? It also says it should not, the Torah shouldn't depart from your mouth. So how are you supposed to gather your grain? And he says, you might have thought that this means that you literally should spend your days only in Torah study. So the pasuk says you shall gather your grain. What does it say? It says, Tam lomar v'safta ganecha hanheg b'hen minag derech eretz. That is, set aside time also for gathering your grain, not only for Torah, but also for work. This is a statement of Rabbi Shmuel. So here you have a stira, Rabbi Shmuel. In one place, Rabbi Shmuel says, you can't do anything other than Torah. In another place, he says, no. Unlike Rashim Lechai, he says, you have to, when it's time to gather the crops, you gather the crops. When you have to plant, you plant, all these sorts of things. So here he's speaking of, like a Torah Derech Eretz. So what is it? So Ramolover said, and this is important for Ramolover, because Ramolover is arguing that we need to teach our young people now secular studies. And if you're going to come to him with an argument from Rabbi Shmuel, well, what's he going to respond? So he says that in the first case, the person where the answer was, find me a time that's neither day nor night, he says that is all, that person was interested, his nephew, not with Sarach HaChayav, Rakla Oneg V'Shashuim. He just wanted to know the language for the sake of knowing it. There are no Greek ideas. He just wanted to be a philosopher or intellectual or something. So for that, if you have Greek wisdom versus Torah, you only do Torah. But to learn so that you can provide for your family, that sort of thing, then Rabbi Shmuel would say, absolutely, you have to. And we decide halacha like Rabbi Shmuel. So here's a good question, though. Would Rav Molivar support the Torah Umada, Rav Lichtenstein idea that, yes, you should read Emerson and the Whitehead and all these things and Augustine? The answer is no. Because Rabbi Shmuel says, we don't need those things. If you find me a time when it's neither day nor night, then you can read Augustine, and then you can read Wordsworth and all these people that Rav Lichtenstein liked. Other than that, you can't. So Rav Lichtenstein, obviously, and the whole Torah Mada philosophy is going to have to find other sources to justify removing oneself from Torah, because if you're reading Milton, you're not reading Torah at that time. But so, as you know, they certainly do have their sources, and they can justify it, and that's not a problem. But he continues in his article that he said, so, you know, why is this even a chiddush, what he's saying? He says that the Gemara tells us that just like a shame, it's a kiddushin. I mean, there's a chiyuv. The Gemara says you have to teach your child a trade. By the way, the Rambam doesn't record this as halacha explicitly. He seems to, we've talked in the past, he seems to refer to it in another place, sort of derech agav, but you'd think that he put this right there. But the Gemara says it explicitly, and I think you can usually take it to the bank that when the Gemara tells you something, especially for practical life, and you do otherwise, it's going to create problems for you. The fact is, there are communities that don't follow this approach of the Gemara, but it's right there in the Gemara. And then he continues, Kol Torah she'eini mamalacha sofa b'teila, that the Chazal also tell us that you have to add something to Torah. Now, of course, what about the people who learn all day? Well, that's referred that when the Gemara says you need to add something to Torah, malacha, it's referring to the average person. You know, the majority of people. Is that 90%? Is that 99%? The point is that it's Torah only. The Gemara tells you itself is not the proper way. That's just not the way the world can work. And then he goes on in this article saying that, don't worry, these schools we set up will be under the supervision of Gedolei HaRabbanim. And then, and when we do that, he says, all the young people, all the families will send their children to these schools. It's interesting in this article, then he speaks about the army situation. I briefly mentioned it last week, but he says that, when the non-Jews attack us and say that we don't want to go to the army, we try to get out of it, he's saying that they do this, they say this because of sinna, and they're just distorting the truth. I mean, this is like I said last class, that some things you have to take with a grain of salt because of the censor. Obviously, when Rav Oliver is writing about how we need to educate secular studies, he means it. But when he writes about how it's a canard to say that the Jews of Russia wanted to get us serving in an army, it's not a canard. Everyone knows that that's something they wanted to do. Okay, let us continue. Let me get my papers out here. Another thing I want to mention, I mean, this is all before we get to his Zionism. He was a leading public intellectual among the Russian rabbinic elite before he started speaking about matters dealing with Zionism. He says, one more thing about the anti-Semitism. He says in an article, he says as follows, this is interesting, that when we're going to see his interest in colonies, settlement, agriculture work in the land of Israel. But he actually started speaking about that in Russia, that we should work the land in Russia. You know, that never really took off. When they saw that this couldn't happen, that's when they got the idea, well, we can have agricultural colonies in America and Argentina. But he's speaking in Russia, and he says that if we are involved in working the land, then the non-Jews won't say to us that we live on the cheshbon acherim. You know what they say, Jews just make a living off of money. And so he says, we have to show them that we can also work the land. And he says, not just working the land, all sorts of professions with our hands. And he says, look at the sages of past in the Gemara, that they were ovdei adama, v'roei tzon. And then he continues that they were also rofim and philosophers, et cetera, et cetera. So he speaks, as I mentioned last class a little bit, but let's read another text. He speaks about how important it is to follow the laws of Russia. He says it's a chov kadosh aleinu, that we had in the Torah, obligated us not to be kfuye tov, ungrateful. This you can find in many writings, but Rav Moliver means it. I'm convinced of that. He says that Russia grants us the ability to live in their land, and today, looking back at it, obviously Russia's a terrible place to live, and they're very oppressive, but at the time, that's what you have. So Chazal have always told us that we need to, Dina de Machusa, Dina applies. Dina de Machusa applies with anti-Semitic governments. This idea that people might think that Dina de Machusa only applies living in democracy, it's not true. Dina de Machusa Dina is established in the days of the sages. The Roman Empire was anti-Semitic, or oppressive to a certain extent. I will say, though, the Jews in Rome, they did not oppress them. At the same time that the Jews of the land of Israel are being oppressed, and even during the revolt, the war, when they're taking back hostages and taking back prisoners and fighting against Jews in the land of Israel, they didn't take it out on the Jews in Rome, which is an amazing thing. But let's say in the land of Israel, Jews were oppressed. In Babylonia, Jews were treated with anti-Semitism throughout the Middle Ages until the United States of America. Every single there was no such thing as a secular government where Jews were not, at least officially, discriminated against religiously. And no one ever said that Dina Malchusa doesn't apply, even to pay taxes more. The Shulchan Aruch is explicit that if Jews have to pay more taxes than non-Jews, you still have to pay it. That's Dina de Malchusa Dina. Now, if they tax us too much, that's considered thievery. Then you don't need to. But the idea that, I mean, it's amazing, because if an anti-Semitic government was elected in any of our countries now, we'd immediately assume that we don't have to be loyal to this government. There's no Dina Machusa Dina, but that's not the halacha. And he goes on talking about how much we have to respect Russia, and that he says that the laws of Russia, Chamurim Yoter Midine HaTorah, Kiyusakanta Vesura. I mean, it can, because you violate these laws, they're more stringent. We have to treat them more stringently than the laws of Torah, because you violate them, it can lead to matters of life and death. And he says that if we follow the laws, even those who hate us the most won't be able to accuse us of things. In other words, you're not going to have pogroms, you're not going to have anti-Semitism. He's hoping. And of course, as we mentioned last class, he's even okay with, I mean, today earlier, he's even okay with Jews serving in the army. I mean, serving in the, his grandson wrote a memoir, and his grandson said that my grandfather, Rav Moliver, thought this was a, when you serve in the army, you're doing it, l'shem Klal Yisrael, not l'shem Russia, but, cause you're showing them that we also are attached to the land. And, the grandson says that, the only way we could expect equality is if we have obligations, and that's the army. Now, granted, he took care, and he wanted to make this is definitely you need to do. He took care in supplying people in the army with kosher food, and that they could have a good environment on Shabbos and holidays. It says that the Jewish soldiers in where Rav Moliver lived, Radom and then Bialystok, they would always, you know, they'd get off on Shabbos. They would be at his house, and they'd eat in his house on Shabbos. So, I mean, I said before that it is true that when Rav Moliver says that the fact that Jews tried, the accusation that Jews tried to get us to serve in the army is a canard, that's not true. They did try to get us to serve in the army. On the other hand, we have his grandson saying that he believed that Jews should serve in the army, that this is something that, just like Jews in Orthodox Jews, even in Germany, thought that you should be in the army, that this is something that he believed in. So quite fascinating. One final thing from these articles, he also, before I even get to that, he says, I don't know what you make of something like this. He says, "Mechuyavim anu b'chabed v'lehov et hanotzrim bizmanin." We have to love and respect the Christians, talking about in Russia, who are following the right path, and the ones who have looked to Israel in a positive way. I guess if you're talking about the ones who treat Jews well, then I guess he is being frank when he says that. But it rings of apologetics, although I don't think it is. But because we're used to, all these svarim that were published in the Russian Empire, on the second page there it says all these laws that are written, the anti-Gentile laws, they don't apply to the wonderful country we're living in. The Tsar, he shall be exalted, and the non-Jews among whom we live, who worship God and treat us so well, etc., etc. And we've always assumed that these are apologetic, not frank statements. But with Ramoliver, it seems it's frank. He also says in another article in Halav Hanon, he says that we created a lot of problems for ourselves because we stopped teaching Tanakh. I mean, this is a common claim in more recent times, but Ramoliver makes it in the 19th century. He says we focus too much on Gemara. And he says, I don't know if this is provocative or not. He says that the people who only study Gemara, you're not going to get the midos you need. Because the midos you need, the positive traits, if you want to get it out of the Gemara, it's scattered all throughout the Gemara. How are you going to find it? How are you going to bring it together? But if you read Torah and Nevi'im, then you can find it very easily. You go throughout the stories we know and Mishlei and things like that. So he says that this is a mistake that we've removed ourselves from Nach, which he says is full of Musar va'Orchot Chaim. Well, again, this is breaking with the traditional yeshiva approach here. Like I said, he becomes Raven Bialystok. He was in Radom, the Hasidic place in Poland. Then he becomes Raven Bialystok in 1883, and he remains there to his death in 1898. Now, if you look at Rav Moliver's writings from the period that we've been discussing before 1883, you would have no idea that he has any connection to Zionism. He appears to be a traditional Rav who's open-minded ideas about how the world is changing, and there were a number of these rabbis. If you read the old periodicals, Halav Hanon and others, you see there are a number of rabbis who thought like this. These are not people in yeshivas. These are in yeshivas. You're just dealing with the elites, but people like Rav Moliver are in cities, and you're dealing with the masses, the Hamonam, and you realize that something needs to change. I think some people might conclude that there's something dangerous when Klal Yisrael is only led by Rosh Yeshiva, because Rosh Yeshiva, by their nature, are segregated or secluded in the yeshivas, and they're not really in touch with the wider world, the outside world. And until really the 1950s, 60s, the leaders were rabbis, not Rosh Yeshiva. There's been a change, obviously, both in leadership and halachic leadership. Before World War II, every great posek was a rav of a city. Even the Netziv was the rav of a lashon. The idea that you decide halacha, you'd be just in a yeshiva, that never occurred to anyone. Today, it's been totally reversed. And are there any communal rabbanim who are also great poskim? Everything goes to the yeshiva. So you wouldn't know that there's any Zionism here. But after his passing, we know, because his grandson, Yosef Moliver, published writings from this very period, before 1883, and we see that he was writing about Zionism, or what, Chovei, I should say, proto-Zionism, but he never published it. Now, why didn't he publish it? It's not clear. He was writing about all sorts of things, and maybe he didn't want to get too controversial. But we see that he adopted the approach of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. We've done classes on Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. They're not yet on the podcast, but we did classes on him. And Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer's idea, which Rav Moliver also believes in, as far as I see, he doesn't mention Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer by name, though, so maybe he came to it independently, or I mean, he certainly knew of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer's ideas, but I don't know if he had a sefer or not, but it was in the air that the redemption is going to come by natural means. He thought that his time era was the era of redemption. And what were the signs, or at least the beginning of the redemption? Emancipation, increasingly strong economic position of the Jews in Europe. I mean, the redemption is going to come naturally. This is an idea that you find many of the Rabbanim say. In fact, the Dor Revi, who has so many interesting things, Rabbi Glasner, Moshe Shmuel Glasner, the introduction to the Dor Revi, which was translated by Yaakov Ellman, not the whole part thing, but a good portion of it, as I recall. I don't think he translated the whole thing, but I mean, the Dor Revi has a whole conception of the oral law, but the Dor Revi, what an unbelievable thinker. But he says that, all these people, when start returning to the land, and he was a big believer in this, there were people who said, no, the redemption has to be miraculous. All these stories about how the Mashiach's going to be miraculous, not come in a natural means, Rav Glasner actually says, by the way, the Rambam doesn't believe in miraculous, but you have lots of other sources. What does Rav Glasner say? He says that all the stories, the Gemara's Midrashim about the miraculous redemption, those are only for the masses, the Hamonam. For all the years in the exile, you want to keep the faith of a messianic era alive in them. So the sages fed them these stories of miraculous redemptions because the idea of a natural redemption would have been impossible to imagine 2,000 years ago and 1,000 years ago. And, how could you imagine anything when a natural redemption? You're living in Provence or in Germany in medieval times, or you're living in the 18th century in Baghdad. I mean, there's no such thing as natural redemption. So they had to then speak in miraculous redemption. And that's what Rav Glasner says. I think that's a little naive of him. I would phrase it differently. I would phrase it that those Gedolim, they didn't say this for the masses. They believed it also because they were also living in Baghdad in the 18th century and living in medieval Germany. They also couldn't imagine redemption in a natural sense. That's why they focused on that. But nevertheless, you still have here and there these statements in the Gemara, Rishonim, that do speak about a natural return. Prophets, perhaps, who didn't even know they were being prophets. There are a number of them. I'll show you in a minute. By the way, he goes further. This is, you could see, I could see why Rav Moaviver, although he was respected by everyone, including the opponents of Zionism, as one of the Gedolim, it could be because they didn't have everything he said. If they had everything he said, they might have been turned off a little about it. So, for instance, Rav Moaviver says, he says that the people who have to take us back to the land of Israel, that is arranged for this, they can't be the Gedolim, the people of the Beis Medrash. Why? He says, Anashim Asher Hikdushu, those people who've devoted all themselves to Torah and Avoda, but don't leave the Beis Medrash. He said they don't have the ability to do what needs to be done to bring about redemption in a natural way. In other words, they can't go negotiate with the Sultan to try to get land and make contracts and you prepare the propaganda to try to influence people to go to Eretz Yisrael. He says that's for the Hamonam, the masses, the business people, the people been out in the world, the Gedolim or the Gedolim, but they have to step back and let other people be in charge of this because the Gedolim are not out there in the practical world. He says, or is it? Found something else interesting. He says, in Yosef Salmon's article on Rav Moaviver, he quotes him as saying, this comes from the grandson. He says that that return to the land of Israel will, what does it mean? Shuv, return. The word chazar, by the way, is not a biblical Hebrew word. Shuv is to return. He says to return to the land of Israel, Shiva, Eretz Yisrael, that is going to lead to tshuva itself. So we'll see the Rav Moaviver is not so concerned that people are not entirely religious who want to return to the land of Israel because the Shiva, what is tshuva? Shiva to Eretz Yisrael will lead to tshuva. Rav Alkali, by the way, says the same thing. And Rav Moaviver says that the redemption will be in a natural fashion, and the Yerushalmi says this in Brachos. Kach hig u'atan shel Yisrael b'tchila kima kima. Redemption will begin in a natural fashion, a little bit, a little bit. And as it goes on, kol mashiach, it says it gets greater and greater. Now, this is something anyone who's been to religious Zionist schools, you know this Gemara Yerushalmi. There's a few Yerushalmis that are famous. Another Yerushalmi deals with what Chol HaMoed, right? That the only reason we have Chol HaMoed, we don't work, is because people are supposed to learn. But now that they're not learning, we can abolish all the restrictions. But of Chol HaMoed. But this Gemara, if you went to religious Zionist school, you know this, that redemption will come slowly, slowly. In fact, this is a popular song now. I'm going to play it for you. My problem is my new computer here. For some reason, when I turn on when I'm on Zoom, I can't pull up YouTube. I can pull up YouTube. I'm saying I can't play it. But fortunately, I have. I'll show you the song, and you could play it on your own. You could watch the lyrics on your own later. If I play it here, it wouldn't work. But you see, it's a popular song, Udi Davidi, and 3.3 million views. And you probably heard it, but you know the tune. I'm going to play it for you now, but maybe you don't know the words. I'll play it until you get to the words, where the words of the song are this Yerushalmi, that redemption comes, kima kima. And they're walking through Jerusalem. Look at Jerusalem. Look what became in 100 years, from nothing to what we have today. So here's, I have another computer here, so you'll be able to hear it, I believe. Actually, I'm going to. I turn the sound off on my, so you'll be able to watch it at the same time that you'll be able to see the singing. There's another one I found, but I don't have it here, which actually has in English the subtitles. You can find it easily. So let me.
וכאילו הכל נעלם, ברחובות עומדים אדם אפשר להרגיש את זה אומרים, סוג גאולה, הנה הנה זה בא, שלם כמעט נשפס, הרוח על אדמת נכר, איילת השחר מפניעה, כל בודי דופק, הגיע כבר הזמן, הנה הנה זה בא. כך יום של ישראל, מתחילה כמעט כמעט, כשהיא הולכת היא הולכת לרמה, כך יום של ישראל, מתחילה כמעט כמעט.
So there you have it. You guys could hear, right, Jay? You could hear the music? Okay, there you got it. One of the very popular songs. I mean, I've heard it too, many, many times. Redemption comes slowly. What does slowly mean? It doesn't come immediately. All of a sudden, you don't wake up one morning and you have a big announcement that Mashiach's here on his donkey and it's time to return to Israel. No, it comes slowly, slowly. And that's obviously the basis of Rav Molliver's understanding of redemption. A few other things in this regard, and it's made very easy finding them because a master's dissertation by a Nurit Merari I'm holding called Eretz Yisrael B'Hagutosher of Shmuel Molliver, The Land of Israel in the Thought of Rav Molliver. So she puts together very nice collection of sources, spared me from having to go through all the articles he wrote. So just to give you some examples, obviously the very first page of this, she cites this Kima Kima, and but he says more than that. He says the Geula tiyeh b'madrega nemucha, he says it's going. What does it mean that the Geula will be on a, like a low level? Exactly the way we see it, that people have to move and they'll have to build and make roads and build settlements and work hard on the land. It's not like this idea all of a sudden. The redemption's here. We're miraculously transported to the land, and crops are just, blossoming everywhere we go. No, it's going to be hard work, because the Gemara speaks about the idea of redemption being quick, happening at its time or not happening at its time. And if it, in short, he talks about, if God doesn't bring it, in a miraculous way, it has to be, as he says, derech hateva. And he says it'll be mitzvah shiflut, and then it'll be the lowest, and then we got to make it greater, etc. He says that the Rishonim, that is, not the Rishonim, it means earlier people, the sages, etc. He says, He says, if the people who came before us, the Rishonim, the Tanaim, the Amoraim, all these great people, if they were not worthy to have a miraculous redemption, we certainly are not going to have to. So in other words, if Rabbi Akiva was not worthy to have a miraculous redemption, if the Rambam and Rashi, why would anyone think that we're going to have a miraculous redemption? We can't. They didn't have it, so then we won't have it because we're not worthier than them. I think the response to him would be, who says I said anything worthy? A God can bring the redemption when he wants for his own reasons at his own times. But no, Rav Moliver sees it otherwise. He says that, but precisely because we're not worthy of a redemption, but derech hanes, therefore we can't just sit around and wait for it, because we have to get in front and bring it, but derech hateva. And he says, anyone who has a seichel yashar, a clear intellect, anyone who basically is smart, can see that the redemption is going to come, as he says, at derech hateva. And he says, God has already begun to show us this. He says, we've received freedoms, emancipations, achuyos, from the government. Now, that's interesting, because you might say just the opposite. You might say that it's precisely when we don't have, when we're oppressed, that that's when the redemption is going to come. But if you see it as coming, bederech hateva, naturally, then you need the freedoms. And now the Jews can leave the ghetto. They can make more money. That enables them to buy land in the land of Israel. That enables them to have influence. So they can put pressure on different governments to allow Jewish settlement, et cetera, et cetera. That's how a natural redemption will come about. And it can only come about if Jews are given rights to develop themselves economically, intellectually, the ways they couldn't be. They have to be let out of the ghetto. He says that's the biggest proof that we're leading in that direction. The same governments that oppressed our forefathers are now treating us much better. And he continues. He says that he has a story here. He has a letter where he writes to another rabbi. And this other rabbi said, I look forward to the day when I can go see the Beis HaMikdash, the Shamein V'Acharev, you know, the destroyed Beis HaMikdash. The remnants of our holy temple. That's what this rabbi wrote. He's writing in the 19th century. Maybe before he dies, he'll be able to move to the land of Israel and see it. And what does, and he said, and this rabbi said to Ramolivar, that's what I'm praying for. And Ramolivar writes back to him. He says, I'm praying that I'll be able to see, I'll be zocha to see the Beis HaMikdash banoy meshulchal, built, you know, ready to be, ready to move, so that we can move in and be able to do all the avoda, everything we're going to need to do. And he says, if I'm not zocha to see that, at least I'll be zocha to move to Eretz Yisrael and redeem the land from the Zarim, you know, the Arabs, and be involved in building up houses and planting fields and vineyards, and Jews living in the land of Israel will enjoy the fruits coming out of the land of Israel. And so, in other words, you want to go to Eretz Yisrael because you want to see the last remnants of our holy temple from 2,000 years ago. I want to go to Israel to see the rebuilt Beis HaMikdash. If I can't see the rebuilt Beis HaMikdash, at least to see the rebuilt Eretz Yisrael with everything that means, which you see every time you go to Israel. People, we all take it so for granted, the idea that in 100 years, 120 years, look what was built. And the other day I saw this person online. He was saying, and you know, it's going to take 80 years to rebuild Gaza. And he's saying, and no one contradicts him. No one says anything to the speaker. And I'm thinking, 80 years? You know, we destroyed Berlin. We built the land of Israel in a lot shorter than 80 years. 80 years. Maybe it'll take them 80 years if they, 80 years. You can knock down every building in New York and rebuild it, and it won't be 80 years. I mean, he goes on. He says, this is important. He says, people misunderstand what it means, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. They think Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is to live in the land of Israel. And that was the perception of these people who would, at the end of their life, they go live there. The people who were living, the Ashkenazim living in the land of Israel, being supported by the Kol system, they're living in the land of Israel. They're fulfilling Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He says that, yes, that is a mitzvah, but that's not, That's not the main aspect of Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. He says there's two things. There's Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael and there's Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael is just living there. But if you just live there alone, just go live there, that's not such a great mitzvah. He says it's only a great mitzvah when, in addition to living there, you are asuk in Yeshuv Eretz Yisrael. What does the Ramban say? He says, the Ramban says that it's a mitzvah, yeshivas haaretz v'yeshuvah. What's the difference? Living in the land and yeshuvah? And he says also, the Ramban says, he quotes the pasuk, you know, the harashtem v'yashavtem. And what is it? He says that there's two types of yeshivas. There's yeshiva, living there, the fact of living there, and yeshuv haaretz. Yeshuv haaretz is building up the land, making it into something, not allowing it to be conquered and taken over by others, working the land. He says, what is Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael? That you live in the land, v'lasosa, and make it Eretz Chemda, b'netios, Uzroim. You plant it there, vineyards and towns. Today, we'd say build buildings and create industry and all that. In his day, the Yeshiva was to create colonies and farms and things like that, vineyards. Now it's, I mean, he says, what's the greatest mitzvah? Netias karamim, you know, upar desim. Hu hayishuv hayater gadol. And then he says, that's the first thing. Then the second thing, binyan batim. And the third, zriyas tavos v'yakaros, building houses and planting crops. I think today, like I said, we would add building roads and bringing in industry and high tech and all this. This is all Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. And anyone who doesn't see this is very short-sighted. I mean, that's Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. In fact, the Chasam Sofer also speaks about this. He's a big follower of the Ramban. He says that that's what Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael is. It's not just living in the land. It's creating something from the land. That's so Rav Reines, he goes on about this. He says that the planting, like vineyards and crops, that's the Ikar Yishuv, and it goes before anything else, because that will bring Parnasat Adam Berelach. That's going to bring the Parnasa. So you see, it's not the planting per se. Some people, you might be thinking, well, it's the planting, because Mitzvah Yishuv, Tulyas Haaretz, no, he says, because that's how you make a living. So today, at the end of the day, unless you're living on a kibbutz, that's not how people go in Israel make a living. So, but anything that will enable Jews to live in the land of Israel, because you can't live there unless you make a living, that's what it means, Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. Now, based on this, and the Chasam Sofer also, if you go, just are in Israel, let's say if you're just learning in Kolel, or if you're just being supported by your parents, or you just whittle away your life, or just living on your trust fund, that's not Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. That's Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. It's a mitzvah, but that's not making the land flower. That's not contributing to the land. He says, I mean, what other parnassas were there? But you see that this is, he's also influenced by this notion that there's something wrong with merchant, being a merchant. You know, the non-Jews always criticize the Jews. And it's true, the Jews were forced into this because they were kicked out of so many other things. But you have this, he has this notion there that working the land is pure and it helps develop you. This is a common idea. Many, many figures had this notion, and that when Jews were able to emancipate themselves from leave the ghetto, the idea was that they can work the land. You know, Rav Kook says that in the exile, we forgot that our bodies are holy. That physical labor is not a negative thing. It's a positive thing. That's how Jews used to work. So he speaks about that you will be free from mischar, from, you know, business, which you were attached to. And it's full, he says, of improprieties and ona'a, that's dishonesty. And when you're involved in business, you never know. You could go bankrupt. He says, but now when you go to Eretz Yisrael and you atem ovdim admas hakodesh b'menucha, and you're going to work the land. In menucha, I don't know if the people working in the kibbutzim, they get such menucha. It's very hard work. I was in Israel in March, and I did the volunteering, and it's hard work, and but that's Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael there. So he's idealizing this idea that we're going to work the Holy Land. And then he says, but we have a problem. Because he recognizes it's not, even if you go there and you work the land, you have to make it a modern country. He says there's a chisaron gadol yesh b'Yerushalayim. There's a problem in Jerusalem because they have an isser there to teach the Arabic language, the French language, also maybe English. He says, but this is a hecherech gadol bismanein ladas lashon ha-medina. He says, today you need to know the native languages and the other languages. Uvi prat be'eretz Yisrael. Asher sham ein mevinim kol lashon ha-medina. He says the people in Eretz Yisrael don't understand Arabic. They don't know Turkish, which is in control of it. They don't know French. They don't know German. They don't know anything. And he says, how can they succeed then? So he says that we have to try hard that this ideology that you can't study languages. And this ideology, a surrogal mode, it's a safa, that you know, you can, it's forbidden to study the language, that this has to be overturned. Because, and why does that have to overturn? Because he says it's necessary for parnosa. He says that the two languages necessary are Arabic and French. Later, of course, English would be important. It's interesting that Turkish he doesn't mention. I would think Turkish because all the government officials were from the Ottoman Empire. Granted, I assume they learned Arabic, but maybe not. That's the balabas, Turkey. So I would think you'd want to know Turkish, but certainly Arabic and French, because French was the language of the diplomatic language. It's not like English is today. In Russia in the 19th century, 18th century, you know, the intellectuals, they learned French. In the Tsarist, among the Tsarist and the Tsarist family, they would speak French. They thought that that was the enlightened language. He says that the masses speak Arabic, and Gedolim Memshala Medabrim Tsarfatit, and the leaders of government speak French. Well, all the Ottoman Empire figures also spoke French. French was a very important language in the Ottoman Empire. So we see very clearly which direction he's going. Okay, so now you have the ideology. How does it work in practice? How are you going to raise the money? What are you going to deal with issues that come up? You got the Shemitah issue. And are you going to have settlements here? What about Jews who are not going to be religious on the settlements? Is that something we can allow? And are all Gedolim going to go along with this? We have a lot to look forward to. So let us stop here. Class number two, let me take some comments, questions here. Rabbi Yellen, what leads me to conclude that Moliver really means what he says? It's not mere apologetics for the censor. Some of it is apologetics, like when he says that this is a canard that Jews tried to get out of the army. We know that they tried to get out of the army. But when he speaks about that Jews should be in the army and that you should love, because not only does he write it, he's cited by his grandson as saying this. And his grandson is already living in the land of Israel, as I recall, Yosef Moliver. And you're talking in the 1920s, he published this. So unless the grandson is also misled and is just concluding this by what he writes. So that's what leads me to conclude. Remember, Rav Moliver is seeing Russia develop the same way that France and Germany developed in England, where Jews are, and he travels to those places, as we'll see, where Jews are given complete rights and they're part of the citizenry. And in those countries, Jews want to take part in everything, and Jews are taught by the rabbis to be full citizens and, you know, relate well to the non-Jews. And in places like Germany, even to be proud to be in the army. If you're seeing Russia develop like that, that's something that you'd want the Jews of Russia to relate to the government the same way they relate in other countries. So that's what leads me to. Where the person who's telling me that I have to click the sound, I understand that, but it's there's something with this computer. I looked into it that even when I'm not sharing, I can't listen to YouTube. It's all choppy when I'm on Zoom. It's a problem with certain computers. So when I played for you just then, I muted it. So you should have only have heard the music from my other computer. Nissan, is a citation of the quoted Yerushalmi Brachos available? I don't have it with me right now, but I'll get it right now because I'll just, these days, it's an amazing world. I'm just, Googling Gula Kima Kima and it'll tell me, where it is. It actually, it's citing it here from, let's see, it's citing it here from Midrash Tehillim, but it's also in Yerushalmi Brachos. I know that. Let's see if I quickly get it. If not, I said, oh, it's in Brachos. It's Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph, right at the beginning, I see, in Yerushalmi Brachos. So there you go. You can look it up. Yes, I'm looking at it right now. It says it's in Yerushalmi is done by Perek and Halacha. It's Amar Abchia, Rabbi or Shem Bachalafta, Be Rabbi, Kachi Gu Osan Shisrael, Bishchigal Kima Kima, Koma Shilachas, Yerabba Salachas. Yes, and then it says, My Time, I quote the pasuk from Micha. So then you find it right at the beginning of Yerushalmi. Yes, and Michael, M.J. Frankel, Gobi Darach HaTeva is titled the study by Ari Morgenstern, the Talmidim of the Gra, who moved to Eretz Yisrael in the 18th, 19th century. Correct. I mean, this was the, well, this was the ideology of the Talmidim of the Gra. The question is, there's a dispute about the Gra, because a lot of this goes back to this work, Kol HaTor, by Hillel of Shklov, which he claims that this is from the Gra, but other people reject it. They think it's more Hillel of Shklov than the Gra. But the Kol HaTor is all about Geula b'Derech HaTeva, and we know that Talmidim of the Gra went on Aliyah. The question is that leading to redemption or not? So I know people have disputed with Morgenstern on this issue, but certainly in terms of Aliyah, the holiness there, even leaving apart whether this is going to bring the redemption, that's a that's obvious. The Vilna Gaon sent his Talmidim there, or his Talmidim, but the Vilna Gaon wanted to go, but heaven prevented him. Jacob says that Turkish was not necessary for the common business, and most of the local leaders spoke Arabic, and Turkish was only necessary for those interacting with Istanbul. But I was wondering, Jacob, though, because the officials from Turkey who were living in the land of Israel, running it as emissaries of the Sultan, I mean, he says that French is good enough to speak to them, so you don't need Turkish. So there's the answer. But it's Rav Kafich. There's a somewhere he writes, or the biography, I think, of Rav Kafech, that his grandfather, Rav Yitzchak Kafech, who was like Rav Molliver, he wanted to introduce languages and other things, modern things, in the schools that he had in Sana'a in Yemen. And I remember, and Turkey can, the Ottoman Empire controlled that also, that he insisted on Turkish, that the students would study Turkish there. And Renissan, thank you, yes, for mentioning what I said, that French was also the language of the native Arabs and Mizrahi elites. When I was in high school in JEC, the teacher, the French teacher, Madame, they called her. I forget what her real name was, but she was an Egyptian Jew. The Jews of Egypt all spoke French. Obviously, we know that the Jews in North Africa that were under their French colonies and in Lebanon spoke French, but this is Egypt. Egypt was not controlled by the French, and Jews spoke French elsewhere as well. That was their language. Okay, thank you all. Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman, 1 p.m., just a reminder that Rabbi Helfgott's shiur on Yeshayahu will not meet this week, parent teacher night. So he's one of the teachers. So that, just for those who are coming Wednesday night, it'll resume next week, just a reminder. And Yaakov Yaffe from Boston will be giving the Parsha shiur this week. And Mark, we look forward to seeing you next week. And want to wish
God
everybody
willing, yes.
Laila Tov. And although, mind you, please God, I will not be here next week because I'll be in Israel. So for going
Ah.
for a few days.
Getting
So
into Israel is not so easy. My daughter
you're
told
telling
me
me
that the
from
flights
Canada
are
there are no
unbelievable
flights.
in LL, and
Yeah.
Israel is not flying through the summer. So I said to her, you got to fly through Europe. And
No, that's what we in Canada there hasn't been a direct flight to Israel since before October 7th because LL stopped flying about 5 years ago. I don't know what the fight with the government. Nobody knows. But from what everybody understands, LL's not coming back to Canada anytime soon. So we're Canada, the whole market itself. But
Yeah,
of
but
course,
could you get a cheap flight from Europe? So it's
no,
not so simple.
it's a fortune. We're going, it's
Yeah.
Atar's graduation is Yoetzet Halacha. That's what we're going for. I'm taking a couple of days
In
off.
Israel?
Yeah, they're doing it in Israel. They were supposed to
Oh.
launch in America. So anyway, so.
One way that works, one way it worked for my grandson, you get to Cyprus. There are cheap flights from Cyprus, many.
It's so crazy.
It's
We're
not so
going
simple to
to
fly to
Rome.
Cyprus. You gotta fly two flights to get to Cyprus. Oh, thank you, iPhone, for saying that Jews in Egypt were educated in French Alliance schools. That's obviously
right. A friend
not
of ours
in Egypt.
Just
all throughout the Middle East, Jews were educated in French schools. Okay.
Yeah,
but,
friend of ours
by the way, if anyone's looking for a vacation and can't go to Israel, because myself, I wanted to go in January, it's very, very difficult. There is a country, we're not going to do a Torah in Motion trip there, but one of the few countries that move their embassy to Jerusalem, and you can reward them, Guatemala. There's amazing hiking. There's things to do there. Lots of interesting things. There's kosher restaurants by the lakes, by in Antigua. Chabad has restaurants there. Apparently, it's a happening place. I know one of the schools in Florida, for their senior trip, they go there. So if you go to Guatemala in a couple months, God willing, you'll see me there. But we should support these countries that, and they haven't backed down. The embassy is still in Jerusalem. Okay,
very
there's
nice.
My plug
whoa.
For
Guatemala. Whoa. And for those who want a more conventional trip, France or Italy, summer of 2025.
Indeed. We have a great trip to Italy and to France. We've done Italy many times. Those who've been on it know that. And this is our inaugural trip to Provence, the land of all the great Rishonim. But it's not just the Rishonim. Jews were all expelled from France. But there was an area there where the Jews were called the Pope's Jews. Because the Pope controlled it. A couple of towns there, including Avignon. And Jews remain there. They remain there, and there's their own minhagim, their own language, and beautiful, amazing shul. Hadassah knows it is. I'm not going to give it away, Hadassah, to everyone listening. But, you know, like I say, Carpentras, and you've perhaps been there. But so there's a lot to see. Nice, Monaco, okay. Monaco is the Jewish community with the largest percentage of in a country outside of the state of Israel. That is, more citizens in Monaco are Jewish percentage wise than any other country in the world other than the state of Israel. And we will have a great time there. So come and bring your friends. Okay. Rabbi Cohen.
Okay, that's it. You can celebrate American independence in France this year. That's
yes.
The first week in July, and Italy's the middle of July. Okay, that's okay. So we got Guatemala, France, Italy, and of course, hopefully one day the airlines will start. I don't get why the American airlines. I don't know if it's insurance money. I don't know why nobody flies to Israel anymore. I don't fully understand it. You can get an Air Canada flight to Tehran if you want. From what I understand, we checked into it. You can go to, the Air Canada Tehran, but not to Jerusalem. It's actually pretty upsetting. Especially when we hear what they wanted to do, Irwin Cutler. I don't know. Was that in the news in the United States?
Yes, it was in the news.
In the United States. Irwin Cutler's an amazing, amazing person. In fact, he's welcome for Torah in Motion. Doesn't mean anything, but he really, really one of the leading lights in Canada. And front page of the paper today, Iran wanted to assassinate him. Oy, oy, oy. Okay, let's hope for good news and good things. And everybody be well, and look forward to seeing you soon at a Torah in Motion Learning. And please invite a friend to join. And Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you.
Tov, tada rabba.
Bakasha.